A couple of questions come this way. One of them just now, somebody asked me if about writing 10th step. I write mine, Bob doesn't. Take your pick with what you want to do. I see in Indianapolis that there's a lot of people who seem to think that the 10th step is the nightly review. And my big book says the 11th step starts at night. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Of course. Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? That's what I understand is the nightly review. The stuff we talked about earlier is the stuff that I take. I write the inventory the minute I find myself that I just stepped in stuff, okay? The minute I've caught myself being resentful, normally. Often when I just find myself afraid, it doesn't happen often anymore, but I've done that. I sat down with it because most of my fears were just the same part of the lie. My biggest fear in my inventory has continued to, for the last several years, show up to be this thing that I sure don't want to look stupid. I'm so afraid of being the fool, and not everybody's going to like me. I'm amazed how many times I've done that, and it's cropped back up. I don't know that there's often in my life that keeps me from doing something that needs to be done, or speaking up at a meeting where it's stupid. I work for a committee, which is bad enough, but my committee is made up of 11 alcoholics, and that's bad. That's crazy. And because I'm still got this, it says long-term sobriety. Iverson says that's being the oldest rat in the barn. So does Mike, incidentally, Tom. He calls me the oldest rat in the barn with that. But I get caught in situations where that particular fear that they're not all going to like me is true. They're not all going to like me. And so, I just as well tell them the truth and move on and forget about it. With that. But anyway, we got out of it. So a few years ago, a guy named Joe showed up in Indianapolis, and he had just moved there from England. And he had been stationed at an Air Force base in England, and a man named Douglas Brown had sat him down with the big book and taken him through the steps, much like we do here. I have no idea who Douglas Brown is or was or that, but he taught them to write the 11th step. And I don't know if I have one in here, but he gave them a format that he'd printed off on Word that all it had was those, I don't know what it is, I think it's 11 questions right there to ask ourselves each night on that. And a piece of paper you can put there, was I resentful? And you have enough room to go to, was I selfish? And you have enough further to go to dishonest or afraid? Do I have an apology? And Joe called me one day after he'd been coming to our meetings. He was glad to find somebody that believed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps. He'd been trying his very best to irritate the South Side that they were doing it wrong, And he did succeed in irritating him. I don't think he changed many. But called me one day, and he says, can we have lunch? I said, of course. He said, can we take enough time to do kind of a fifth step? And I said, okay, how long do you think it'll be? He said, maybe 10, 15 minutes. I said, well, you really haven't been a bad alcoholic as I am. And then he said, no. He said, it shouldn't take any more than that. And so I said, oh, what the heck? So we went and sat down at the hamburger place. They call them Steak and Shake in Indiana. And we went in there, and after dinner, he opened up a ring binder, and that's what he had, was a ring binder full of these sheets of paper, one for each day. And he said, this won't take long. And so he goes through that, and he must have fanned through the first three or four before he had one that's writing on it. And he would share what it was in there and all that. And so he would just share each one of those. And we went through 2 months, literally, in 15, 20 minutes. And it was done with some insight and that. And when he had some that he had made, he owed an amend, he wrote down how he made it and what he'd done. And so that didn't leave much of a question other than, is there any more to do? Have you got that? He says, yeah, I got to go quit going to make amends to that lady. She told me to stop it. But anyway, this process of the nightly review really covers a lot of ground, and it really does. And it doesn't take long. I'm better at it now than I've ever been. If I'm tired enough, the nightly review could go out the window. I ain't doing that. The older I get, the more tired enough I am. And then anyway, Joe pretty much showed me that way. And I show that to a lot of people to help them get started. And Julie and I will often do it on our way to bed. We got a little table not far from where we go that we do our morning meditation together in. And we keep a stack of these things there when we do it. And we just kind of go down and ask each other to list anymore. I don't do much anymore. I couldn't fifth step with my wife. I don't often. Just, you don't want to give them a leg up if you don't have to. But that's just really been a part of the deal for me. I pretty much follow the book in my meditation here, my morning meditation. And just like it says, on awaking, we think about the 24 hours a day, and we consider our plans for the day. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I've said that prayer a lot, and it's for a long, long time in my morning meditation. But I listened to Mary Thayer two, 3 years ago, and she talked about, she writes down the first thought that comes to her mind right after she asks God to divorce her thinking from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives, because she thinks that's the clearest thought she's going to have all day. And I thought, boy, that's probably right. And so I try to do that now. And you can tell her I stole it. Well, I'll make amends later. But I really found that to be helpful sometimes. It often is. And I think that's true, because the more I think, the goofier it gets oftentimes. But I will go through that, and I will write down some plans for the day. And some days there's more things that you need to get done than others and that sort of thing. But I like to keep paper and pencil there to write some things down, and something I learned that a long time ago. Anyway, let me go on with that a little bit, and then I'll share some more. Talking about learning to rely on inspiration, as time goes by, I find that I don't recognize any inspiration necessarily in my morning meditation, my morning thinking. But what I do find is throughout the day is all of a sudden I'll go do something and it must have been inspired because it really turned out well and I hadn't thought of it before I went and done it. And so I think I do rely on that, to do that. And then after we've both kind of done that, Julie and I will sit together and we'll do a morning meditation together. Over the years, I have tried centering prayer. I have just about tried anything you could come up with to try to sit and meditate. And some of it has been very useful for me. And some of it, I think, got me lost. Paul had taught me about ceaseless prayer. And he made me read a book about that. Story of a pilgrim in Russia in nearly medieval days. And he had read in the Bible where Paul says that we are to pray without ceasing. He says, come now, how the hell do we do that? And he went and asked a bunch of monks, and he got an idea how to do that. And so I picked that up, and it's not the most commonplace thing, but I worked at it. And it's probably the one that I do the most, because the mantra I learned back then appears in my mind without being asked for. And it just shows up. And that's just because I've done it that much, and it's done that. I check it out with a couple of people who do a lot of meditation with that. And a while back, I attended a men's retreat, and it was run by a nun named Mary Margaret Funk. And if you want to learn about meditation, get her books and read them. I know you didn't forget the name. It's pretty hard to forget. And she was a great deal of help in it. But she was at she led a men's retreat one day. I attended, and she would go through the subject material, and then the beginning of each hour, she'd tap a Japanese or a singing bowl with the mallet and tell us to let our thoughts ride off on the sound. You know how the chime will start louder and then taper off. And do that. And I found it immensely helpful. And she says, I don't care what you do to meditate. She says, I think one is as good as another. And what do you do? She says, even if you do ceaseless prayer. She says, that's fine. I don't care. Just do it. And we would sit for 5 minutes before we went on into the next session. And so I went up to her later and I says, you're the first guru. And she didn't like it. But I said, you're the first guru I've had say anything to me about ceaseless prayer. And I said, that's what I learned to do. And she says, how did you learn about it? And I told her, an AA sponsor who gave me this book. And she said, tell me, is that something you call upon? Or does it seem to come with itself? And I said, both. And she said, don't mess with it. It's just fine and it's working. And so I don't mess with it, and it's just fine. And that's what I do most of the time when I am done with my day and planning my day and doing that. And I think Julie has learned to do that and does that now too. We may sit together, but we're not necessarily meditating or thinking about that. And if it comes times that we got to involve one or the other in our plans for the day, then we discuss it and move on. I have found that my evening meditation and going through what I call the checklist at night is probably the most important part of my meditation. And the reason I say that, if I've answered those questions that were given in that checklist, I'm done with those, and my morning meditation is so much more clear because I've set all the garbage aside the night before, so my morning meditation is just there. And it's there for the day and for what I have to do when I do it. One of the mid-timers that I call in our group now is guys that I see as very young men who are about 20, they are 20 years sober and all that. But a number of years ago, one of those guys had caught on to, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. And I remember hearing about that in Denver out at the Showgirl Club, Bob. Mm-hmm. And Clavel would be talking about it. And he was a guy who would pull off to the side of the interstate, of Interstate 25, which isn't the best idea at any time, but he would do that just to get settled down. And he says the pause really works. And he says he consciously would pull off the side and force himself to sit there for maybe 5 minutes and let the traffic go by before he'd pull back in. And then he could get back to work and settle down and ready to go to work. He was a pretty successful guy would do that. And then my friend Matt, who was at my group in Indianapolis, talks about the power of the pause. And he just said he discovered the power of the pause, and he shared all these instances in his life where the power of the pause was set in. At times where he was invited to go do something with his wife that he really didn't want to do, he said the power of the pause was really helpful there. And use it all. Now he's using it with the baby that needs his help at night. And things like that. So I like talking about that because that pause is just super. Around the same subject, and I'm trying to remember just how it came up, but in that same meeting I just talked about, there's a tall old guy there that they called Sarge Hancock, and he would talk about the power of the pause in his life, and he talked more about confining our life to a 24-hour day more than anybody I remember. You don't hardly hear that anymore, do you? We used to talk about, but Sarge used to say, we don't need a program to last us the rest of our life. We don't need one to last us all day. And that would have been so true. And then somehow he would bring that into the power of the pause. And I wish I could remember why. But the power of the pause gets me back in today. When I sit down and do it, and I'm asking myself, is there any more I can do about it right now? Maybe there is. Maybe I got to pick up the phone and call somebody. Or maybe I got to do something. But maybe there's not a damn thing but to set it aside and move on with the day and confine it to the day. But that's how I see prayer and meditation. I don't see it as too involved. I don't know that that makes me any more spiritual or any less spiritual than somebody that doesn't do it at all. But what I do know is my ability to focus is improved over time. Doesn't mean I have days where I have no days where there's a complete lapse, because certainly I do. But over time and in the long haul, my ability to focus, whether it's in my work, and my work effectively is there simply for the new person to come in there. It's the only reason my office is there, and that's the only reason I do that. So if I'm thinking about anything other than the new guy or gal coming in, I'm losing track of where we're at. So my focus will always be there instead of maybe how are we going to have enough money to pay the bills this month in this office or something like that. But it's just the way it is. I don't think it makes me any more holy or anything else. But it's become a very important part of our lives, my bride's and myself. Our youngest daughter, when the weather's bad like we've had this year, she lives about 60 miles down in the hills in the holler south of us. And she'll come up and spend the night with us because she didn't want to drive back down there and then drive back in the morning in the snow and the ice. And so she'll get up in the morning and come in and sit with us. With that, and she's had a horrible time this last couple of years, and has found that the spiritual life worked. What she had was a seizure at our house, and she hit her head twice on the way down, one on the doorknob on the pantry, and then on our floor. Our house is on a slab, and so her head hit the concrete floor, the tile. And I don't know about you guys, but I grew up on ice skating rinks and things like that. And I've heard heads hit ice. I've heard heads hit concrete and all that. And the only sound as close to it is when you take a pumpkin and throw it down on the concrete like that. That's a very similar sound. All I knew was she was hurt. I wasn't in the room when she did. And all I knew is she was hurt. And I have an old Australian cattle dog that's 14 years old then, who's deaf and blind, but she heard the injury, and she beats me to the door to go in there, and Julie hadn't seen it either, and I realized looking at her she was having a seizure, and Julie come running around the corner wanting to help, and I says, we got to stick something in her mouth so she doesn't swallow her tongue. And Julie starts to put her finger in there. I says, oh, no! You'll lose that finger right now. But anyway, now after some time later and some pretty heavy they call them psychotropic.
Psychotropic
drugs that she's on to prevent further seizures and that sort of thing. She seems to find that the way of the Spirit is making her life better. She doesn't come ask me for coaching very much anymore, but she does remember birthdays and that sort of thing. She just kind of wants to sit and talk, and then she'll remember to reach in the purse and give me my birthday cigar, and we have a nice time. But I just watch the way of the Spirit with her. Our oldest daughter, I was telling Kristen they are the same age, and not quite old broads, but they're gaining on it. It's not. and she's always been a spiritual girl and always believed in meditation and yoga and things like that. And we always wondered if she was our child. Anyway, I'm done.
Just a couple of things. The exercise of pausing when agitated or doubtful and asking for the right thought or action kept me out of a lot of trouble, especially working with inmates. They have a tendency to be antisocial anyway, so things are liable to happen at the drop of a hat. And if some inmate comes up to me and says, "You're an asshole," or whatever they're going to say, and moves towards me, I have to go past a lot of old habits because my traditional way of dealing with someone moving toward me is to move toward them faster. And now what I have to do is I have to pause. And sometimes I'll say that, pause. And people will look at me and, you know, and I won't step back physically most of the time, but I'll step back emotionally. And what I'll say is, "God, show me what's going on here." That's one of the reasons why I'm not afraid. And then I'll just wait for an answer. And I get an answer about what to do next. It's all intuitive. And instead of doing this traditional thing about, "You want to intimidate me? Let me show you what intimidation looks like." I don't have to do that. And once you've sort of dropped your defense, it's a strange thing because then they're no longer aggressive. Just a couple of practical things about the 11th step. One of them is I have a terrible time doing an evening review when I go to bed because I can't stay awake.
Right.
By the time I go to bed, I'm done. I'm flat out of gas. So I'll do an evening review at 7 o'clock at night. I may do an evening review at 5 o'clock. And the reason why is because I'm still awake. And I can take a look at all of those questions with some clarity. And so if you can't do it any other way, try what I tried, which is do it, like a lot of times I'll do it before I go to a meeting. And if I'm there, you know, if I'm just sitting in a recliner or something at 7 o'clock, instead of turning on the television, I'll do my evening review. Wow.
Bring it up to the mic, Jaime. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, okay. Timo. Too bad half the people in here don't know what's so funny about it.
And then the business about the morning, it says we review our plans for the day. In order to review our plans for the day, we have to have some. So it's been helpful to me to, during there at the end of the evening review, to just note a whole bunch of things I want to do the next day. I'll do like 10 or 12 things that I want to do tomorrow. Two of them are be happy, help someone else, and a bunch of them are business things. And I'll write down what I think I want to do for tomorrow, and then when I get up in the morning, I review it. And sometimes I change things and sometimes I don't. Why would you do that? You know that most people get out of bed in the morning going, oh shit. Now what's going to happen? Right? If you got a plan, you don't do that. Because you have some semblance of thought about what is going to happen. And a lot of times that doesn't happen. A lot of the time you'll go out and you'll have this whole big wonderful plan for tomorrow, and you'll get involved in the day and it'll take a right turn. That's okay. But see, one of the reasons why so many people get out of bed with high anxiety in the morning is because they have no plan. You get that? So when you get up in the morning, if you have some idea about what you're going to do that day, you can go through that day with a real sense of confidence about what that day is going to look like. And when you make your plan for the day, certainly plan those things which are necessary, some action that's necessary, like send somebody a birthday card, or go to this business meeting, or have lunch with so-and-so, or go to a meeting tonight, or whatever. But there are other considerations in your day. One of them is, what kind of an attitude are you going to carry? Okay? One of the things that you may do well incorporating in your plan for the day is what I suggested, carrying the vision of God's will into all your activities. So, you know, part of it is what I'm going to think, and part of it's what I'm going to do. And once you've established that, then you go launch out into your day. Most people spend their lives reacting. And it makes a lot more sense to have a plan. That's a good business thing, by the way. Now, I taught business skills for a lot of years. And one of the best things to do in business is to make lists. Now, I'm sure some of you are compulsive enough to make lists. But making a list is wonderful, and especially if it includes what you're planning on doing. So your anxiety level can drop about 50% if you're willing to make a list of the things you want to do the next day, the night before. Okay? So I think we only got about a half an hour left in this thing, and I think we ought to talk about the 12th step. Want to do that, or you want
me to? Yeah, go ahead.
I spend a lot of time working with people. I only know one way to do that, and that's what they did with me. What Gary and Don and all those guys did for me when I came in here with my butt hanging out. And that is to sit down, start at the beginning of the book, and read. Sometimes you just have to intervene. It isn't about sponsorship, it's about stopping the process somewhere. Sometimes you just have to do something to change the direction of someone's life, and I think that's as much 12-step as anything. Part of that has to do with what kind of position are you willing to take in a meeting if somebody's dying right in front of you. I have seen so many meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous where someone was in there in absolute terror, saying that they were that this thing was going to kill them, and they didn't know how to stop, and nobody said anything. Nobody said anything that made sense. I've been in meetings where people said, I'm dying from this disease, I can't stop drinking, I don't know what to do, and I'm sick as a dog, and I can't live this way any longer, and I'm either going to have to get sober or shoot myself. And I've seen people, I mean, the first time I went to my home group before they did steps, they had these two old-timers in there, and they would defer to them. And they asked this lady, who was one of the founders of the group, and they said, well, Peg, what do you think? After this woman had just practically burst into tears knowing this thing was going to kill her. And she said, well, you hang in there, honey. That's worse than no message. And when she got done saying that, she went over and she said, and Wayne, what do you have to say? And the guy said, well, honey, you're not here because you ate too many peanuts.
In the whole house, actually. Uh-huh. Oh, shit, I remember them.
And that's more than I could stand. So I got up and said, you know, don't listen to these old people with cobwebs on their elbows. They don't have a fucking clue about how to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you'd like to learn how to recover, find someone in this group that knows what the recovery process is, and it's told to us precisely in the big book. And listening to someone saying something inane about your situation may kill you. So it's right after that, this founder lady jumped up and said, you're a horse's ass. And I said, uh-huh. You know, if you're going to 12-step somebody, tell them the truth. Even if it makes you look bad. Are you going to be the only person in the room that has the courage to address someone that's dying from alcoholism and tell them the truth, even though people in the room may recoil from you? Are you willing to talk strongly enough to someone who's dying to get their attention? Do you know what to do when you get them? I mean, this is a pretty simple process. There's no mystery to this. You just get them in here and get them engaged in a recovery process, and then they can recover from alcoholism just like you did. I think you tell people the truth. You say, you know, in most cases we don't, because some of the things that we truly ought to share with people, we don't, and with good cause. One of them is, incidentally, you're going to have to change your mind about everything. And there's a great deal of truth in that. Over time, you virtually will change your mind about everything. And, you know, if first of all, there's an awful lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that don't want to do this. And I don't know why. I mean, what rational person would want to live in that kind of anger and frustration and in pain that people without a solution for their alcoholism live in? But a lot of people will do that. So when you're 12-stepping someone, What you do is you carry a clear message about the recovery process and what effect it's had on you. Now, let me tell you something my sponsor told me when I started going to this meeting. The one that I described with the two people telling the newcomers to hang in there and everything. I used to have to tent step with my sponsor every time I came home from that meeting. And I would just be beside myself. And I'd call up Don and I'd say, I got to tent step this meeting. I mean, those people, they sit there in the face of someone's impending death from this disease, and they tell them cheap little bullshit that doesn't make any sense, and, you know, what the hell's going on here? And he'd go, what did you do? And I'd go, I got up in the middle of the meeting and told them they were all full of shit. One night I got up in the middle of the meeting and I said, you ought to call this the Englewood Sobriety Association because it sure as hell isn't Alcoholics Anonymous. That makes a lot of friends. And he said, here's what you're going to do, Bob. And I said, what's that? And he said, from this point forward, the only two things that you get to say in that meeting is what your experience is and what it says in the big book. And I said, why? And he said, get off of your horse. You know, you're not the AA police. So he said, here's why I want you to do that. First of all, they don't know what your experience is. They weren't there. And I said, okay. And he said, the other thing is they don't know what's in the big book. So they can't argue with either thing you say. And he said, so in the future, all you do is you get up and say those two things and then sit down and shut up. So I did that. And here's what happened. I did that for 6 months, going to meetings like three or four times a week at that club. And nobody, or I shouldn't say that, very few people would talk to me. And after about 6 months, this guy named Al comes up to me and he goes, I didn't do that. We were talking about the third step and he said, I didn't do that. And I said, okay. And he said, no, you don't understand. I didn't do what you said. And I said, no, you don't understand. That's okay. And he said, well, what's going to happen if I didn't do that? I said, I don't know. You know, the worst thing that can happen is you'll drink again. And he said, well, will you show me what you did? Oh, boy. Gotcha. And I said, yeah. But you're going to have to agree to going through this whole process. And if you're willing to do it from start to finish, I'll show you how to do it. So he said, all right. And I showed him how to do that. And then not too long after that, he was out sponsoring people. And then another guy came up to me and he said, hey, you took Al through the steps? And I said, yeah. And he said, would you do that with me? And I said, uh-huh. And so I did it with him. Now, then he started going out and sponsoring people. After about, then the old-timers in that group, there turned out to be about 12 of us that had been through the steps then. And the old-timers in that group told us to go in the basement and have a meeting because we weren't welcome upstairs anymore. Uh-huh. And so we went into the basement and had the meeting and started one of the largest young people's groups that Denver ever had down there at the same time. And after about 6 months of that, everybody was coming into the basement, and about two or three of those old-timers were sitting up on the first floor by themselves. And then they quit the group and went somewhere else. Now, here's what will happen. There's an interesting word in the English language. The word is inexorable. Inexorable. And what it means is unstoppable. And there is nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that is unstoppable as the truth. And so what will happen over time if you have the courage to do it is, as long as you sit in a meeting and you show up there regularly so people know that you're interested enough to at least be there on a regular basis, and you sit in there and quietly tell the truth, you will polarize a whole group. Right? The book talks about finding the fellowship that you crave. It talks about the fellowship growing up around you. And if you want to experience that, stay in one place long enough so it can happen. It can take years. But I started going to my home group a little over 30 years ago. And I have the fellowship that I crave. People make a point of coming to the Happy Way group in Englewood when they come into the Denver metro area because they know they're going to go to a real AA meeting. Right? And you're all welcome to come there when you come to Denver. So we're on the second floor of the Wells Fargo building right out of downtown Englewood. And if you go into that meeting, you can rely on the fact that they're going to talk about recovery. If you want to be a good 12-stepper, if you just make sure that you know the message doesn't change. The message is do this. The message is... One of the best lines in the book. We will show you what we have done. It doesn't say we'll show you what you ought to do. Okay? Say, I'll show you what I did. And then if you're interested enough, I'll help you go do it. And I'm not going to be your master. I'm not going to be your leader. I'm going to walk with you through this, and I'm going to try and help you, if you're interested, to do what I did. And if you're willing to do that and you're not beating somebody over the head with this whole thing, they'll do that. Your message, when you go to AA meetings, is going to speak louder than anything else. How you handle yourself. When people watch you just in life, is going to make a huge difference in what people think about you. You know, I had a guy come up to me and say, after I'd gone through a divorce, I hit like a huge catastrophe when I was about 7 years sober. And this guy came up to me and said, I learned more watching you go through that difficulty than I learned when you took me through the steps. And he said, watching you go through that with some modest level of dignity said more to me than anything you've ever shown me. Okay? We are examples of this. And, you know, people are always watching. Some of the people we talk to, we're sitting there pitching somebody, and 6 months later, a guy that was standing in a corner will come up and go, I got to talk to you about what you were saying to this guy. And you didn't even know they were listening. Everything we do has effect. And the question is, you know, are you willing to go out there and be pretty straightforward about all of this? You notice, I'm probably a little too much that way, but I think it's funny. See, so, but do you have the courage to go tell somebody the truth? Do you have the courage of your convictions? Will you make an asshole out of yourself in the middle of a meeting to carry a message? Or are you so protective of your reputation that you're afraid to say anything? You know, this Frank McGibbon came up to me one day and he said, "What do you stand for?" And I'm looking at him and I'm going, "Is that a trick question?" And I said, "Well, I'm not really sure." And he said, "Then you don't stand for anything." Oh, what? Another question that he asked me, or what are your principles? I had to go write them down. I had to write down how I wanted to live my life. What are the guideposts of my life? Do you have the courage of your convictions? Or are you going to go hide in a corner if you're put on the spot? If you see someone dying from alcoholism, are you willing to intervene no matter what the cost is to you? You're going to need to ask yourself all these questions. Then you're going to have to learn how to walk through your fear. Because that's what you got to do to go do this. You know, the book talks about being on the leading edge of God's ever-advancing creation. That means you've got to be out in front. That means if there's a drunk out there that's suffering in front of you, carry a clear message to them. No bullshit, no fluff, no window dressing, no none of that stuff. Just straightforward, I can show you precisely how to recover. How many times have you heard that in a meeting? I mean, the book says it. Can you say it? I mean, I've said that to people, and other people look at me and go, "Whoa, what an asshole." Wait a minute, that's what it says. I can show you precisely how to recover. I've told people that in meetings that needed to be 12-step. And they go, and I want to talk to you about sponsorship, and I'll tell them, "Well, I can show you precisely how to recover, but it has to do with your willingness to do it. I can show you what to do, but it's up to you to do it." I watch new people who get sponsees, and they get their ego all wrapped around them. And they think that in some manner that they are keeping these people sober. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, it's up to the person who comes in. If I lose someone, if they go out and drink, You know, I'll just go home and do stuff with my kids. And I tell people that. If you go die, I may not notice. So be clear, be precise, and be unafraid when you do this. And wonderful things will happen. I have an awful lot of people that I sponsored that I still see, Some of them have been sober over 30 years. It's a fellowship that I crave. We are all of a like mind. We can all get in the same place and talk about the same stuff. And it's really, when a newcomer comes into a meeting and they look at people, there are some meetings where people are so damn spiritual they almost float away. And what it looks like is they're all playing off of each other. They're all playing off of each other and they're all kind of trying to outdo each other in how spiritual they are. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but we have that. Do you know what happens when a newcomer comes into that meeting? They leave. You know why? Because it isn't about them. And see, our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And admittedly, there are people who've been sober for a while who are still suffering. But when people come into an AA meeting, it ought to be about them. And that means that after the meeting, if they're a newcomer, that somebody goes and talks to them. I've been in meetings where there are no new people, and as soon as the meeting stops, all the old buddies get together, and that new person is standing there all by themselves. What the hell are you thinking? You know what? Go find them, go help them, that's the point.
I think we're done.
Anything you say, boss. All right.
I think we're about ready to eat dinner. And I think I have probably enjoyed it. I've had the prime seat in the house here. You know that. I've had the best seat in the house for this thing. And, but 10 minutes. No, you said 5:30? Okay. A quick comment. I think over the years I've worked very hard at just sharing my experience. I have found that to be, at least that's what I think I do. Let me put it that way. If I'm talking at a meeting and all that, and even if it's a meeting where they don't use the big book and I'm called on and all that, I just share my experience with the big book. I don't tell them it's out of the big book. I just share that's what I did. Occasionally, a good friend of mine goes to a 12-and-12 meeting on Friday nights, and I'll go up there. I know a lot of the people. I'm friends with them and all that. But if they're talking about the step, I don't have the experience to share with them out of the 12-and-12. Probably not going to have, because that means I got to pick it up and read it. there's probably some good stuff in there. I just don't know. So I just share my experience. I don't
tell
them. You
think he's joking?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. No, that's true. I'll read the traditions essays. They're important. You ought to be reading. You ought to get to know a lot about them. Put them in your lives. But it's just so important for me just to share my experience. That's worked more often than not. Now, what Bob says here and does, I don't think I do. But I'll have people come back to me and they say, Gary, you've saved our lives. You are so adamant about what you did. And I don't feel myself getting in their face about much of anything. If you'll know I'm getting in the face because I'll start my sentence with bullshit. and there's no doubt about it, because at that point, I'm sharing my experience. I just think that's so important. Try to go in without an attitude, but to share the experience and keep it to that. And that's hard to do, because many of us will go through what we do here, and after we've done it for 2 or 3 years, what I did and the Diggs did back in Indianapolis is we started referring to other AA groups as AA Light. Some of them took exception to that. But we thought it was kind of cute, because we thought we really had our answer and all of that. And that meant we weren't looking at that other group, because there were some successful AAs there. I didn't like the way they do that. But they were after that first that new person that came in. They weren't sitting there watching them come out and that sort of thing. And they would tell them to come down to our group and see if that's what they wanted. And they do. And we have pretty good luck. I defy a new person to walk in our room and make it out of there that night. It ain't going to happen. With that, and it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman, they're not going to happen. They're going to go after him. Funniest thing I ever saw in that group one time, and I knew he was coming, and I knew who else was going to be there, and the age was right to come in there. And he says, I got an announcement at the end of the meeting, and he said, I'm sober just a few weeks, whatever it was, and I was sent down to this meeting to find a sponsor. And he nearly got killed before it was over, because 6 guys were over there with him right now. And he got the right sponsor. He really did. Happens to be my son-in-law. But he's a great sponsor for somebody like that. You catch a street kid coming in off the street that's really smart on the street, he finds out just how smart he is. And he does great. But we just share our experience in the meetings, and we don't show our attitudes like we did once before, and we seem to be a little more successful. So and it's hard to do, because I know I'm right. But try to share your experience without an attitude. It's so easy to think that this is not God's deal. Bob said it last night. I can go through the mechanics of this time after time, and it doesn't matter how right I do it, it's still God's deal. It's going to come out the way he wants it, like it or not. And I love it. Sir? I'm just going to touch on that. There seem to be people who... Well, let me rephrase that. Let's look at service just briefly. All of service is designed to help the new person. Everything service does, be it intergroup or your area, your district, or whatever it is, those things they're doing with CPC or what do you call it out here, H&I or that sort of thing, it's all geared to carrying our message to the new guy. Let's take it out of the idea of being politics and all that. It's like anything else in AA. There's just an awful lot of bullshit in it, but it does help a lot of people that you don't get too handily. We're getting into the prisons or the jitter joints, and we're doing a lot of help for people. So, yeah, I believe in it, and I do it. I sponsored a guy when he first came in. I took him to a quarterly meeting down in Montrose, Colorado, and it was contentious. And those guys were in there fighting like crazy. When he and I jumped in the car and we're headed home, he says, "Man, I didn't like that." He said, "I don't ever want to do that again." And it seems like 2 days later, he's trustee at large carrying AA into Russia. So let's get serious about it. If you haven't done it, go ahead and call Harvey down at the central office and get your name on the 12-step list. Yep, set up and get counted. If you get a call, get somebody else and go take care of it. But it's important. Get involved in it. Yes, Shelley. That's a setup, Wolf, and you know that. God damn it. I have the power of God that I'm willing to open myself up to. If I'm doing this as a part of the program and a part of the thing that he set out for me, of course I do. In and of myself, I don't have shit. Okay? I'll get you. anything else? Can we close it?
Okay.
Are we ready? Well, wait, just a minute. I don't know about anybody else in here, but I am delighted that you and Shelley asked us to come here. I'm really glad.
Took us to get them together about 2.5 years it took us. We didn't know what time or what day, but they decided and they got here. And I really appreciate it. I want to tell you after you eat, there will be here 6 people that will talk about Jaime and Shelley. They're going to roast us to death. So please don't leave. You have a choir of 30 people coming. You have a comedian and you have a rapper. And that's where we finish. And you're going to have the real cake. Whatever cake you ate was I don't know how to say that, but it was a cake. But the real cake is coming like 8 o'clock. And that's chocolate velvet cake. So please save that. I don't want to throw that away. So with that, what I need you to do, please go out that door and go around and come back right there. That's where we start the line. I got a 3 rocks, the table, make sure you throw your copy.